handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over.
Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds HEBT. TOT 53.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Denise Simon Experience. We are so pleased that you are able to join us. And I also want to give a big shout out to WDDQ Talk 92.1. They're so kind and generous with their airtime for the Denise Simon Experience. And the Denise Simon Experience has invited back Ashley Varner with the Freedom Foundation, freedomfoundation.com. She's a previous guest, hasn't been on with us for a while, but that doesn't mean that the Freedom Foundation isn't doing some serious work. And Ashley's actually going to share a case with us that the Freedom Foundation and other good law firms, you know, there's a lot of interesting lawsuits that are out there, and Freedom Foundation is one of the ones that, you know, work these. So, Ashley, welcome back. Happy New Year and all that stuff.
Happy New Year, Denise. It has been a while, but it's always good to talk with you. So thanks for having the Freedom Foundation back on.
You're kind to say that. Now, we have something here that, you know, your organization has brought to my attention, hence the reason that you're with us, and that is an unconstitutional out-of-state capital gains tax scheme. And before you get into the description of that, I would argue that a lot of what goes on in Washington and Oregon and California are kind of legal incubation centers, if you will. They incubate these harebrained things, and if they work in a couple of states, then it sort of migrates itself to other progressive states. But that's just kind of where I am on that one. So,
you are absolutely right. There's an unfortunate saying that so goes California, or as goes California, so goes the nation. And it is terrifically true. And I mean terror, because the things that California has wrought upon this country by passing things in their insane General Assembly, same thing's going on in Washington and Oregon. The West Coast, the Left Coast, it's no surprise that we refer to their circuit judges as the Ninth Circus. I mean, they are just crazy out there. But yet, whatever they get to go through their processes, their legislatures, it eventually finds its way into other blue states and then into the halls of Congress, unfortunately. So yes, what happens there? I lovingly joke that, you know, we live on the East Coast time zone, or maybe many of your listeners do, but my colleagues on the West Coast, they're 3 hours in the past, so I have to keep an eye on what's going on back there, but it's important. And this capital gains tax, Denise, unfortunately, it will have ramifications for your audience and your listeners, particularly as it pertains to left-leaning states wanting to get the last bit that they can out of their tax base that is leaving them for states like Florida.
Well, Florida has a sign up at our state border that says no vacancy, we're full. So we hope everybody turns around on I-95 and I-75 and goes in another direction, but nonetheless. I think this actually was also too in the California legislature, where there was a discussion here that they were going to, you know, businesses and people that were leaving, they wanted to have them, force them to pay taxes, California taxes, even up to 5 years after they moved out of the state. Is that right?
I believe that's correct. J.D. Pritzker, governor of Illinois, mm-hmm. is trying the same thing. They're kind of blanketly referring to it as a millionaire's tax.
Yes.
Because, of course, they want to lambast the people who are leaving their unfair tax climates for better states like Florida. So they want to make them the bad guy. But really, it's a matter of these state legislatures want to do too much with other people's money. That's not the government's money. The government doesn't create anything except for printing more money. But that's our money. That's your money. It's my money. It's everybody in your listening audience. They're the taxpayers. And these governors and these state legislators just think they have a right to reach into your back pocket before you even get your full paycheck and take whatever they want out of your taxes.
Well, they've gotten away with it so far.
Well, they have. And unfortunately, last week, the Supreme Court, they declined to hear our challenge to this new Washington state capital gains tax. So we are about to see whether or not this Washington state law is going to become a blueprint for California, Oregon, Illinois, New York, Minnesota.
Pennsylvania, Maine. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, tell us what it is. Explain it to us, because this is kind of an alarm bell. So help us with this.
Sure. So this has been going on for several years in the Washington state legislature, and the Freedom Foundation has been really the leading organization fighting this all the way back 10 years ago when it was the Seattle City Council trying to pass an income tax on people. So Washington is one of the last states that does not actually have an income tax. I believe Florida is another. But
Tennessee,
Washington,
yeah.
For all of Washington's bad laws, this is one thing they've managed to protect, and that is no income tax on their citizens that is like a graduated tax on income. So for over 100 years, the legislature has tried and failed to get ballot measures passed. The people have rejected this every time. So in 2021, the state legislature they forced through a bill that would institute a 7% income tax on capital gains or financial gains realized over $250,000. And it passed the legislature, and the Freedom Foundation was the very first organization to file a lawsuit challenging it. We challenged it in court before Governor Jay Inslee was even able to sign it into law. That's how serious we are about protecting this.
Is it any and all capital gains, Ashley?
It looks like it. And of course, I'm not a CPA, but we have been going over this now for almost 3 years. We've been fighting this in courts. The Freedom Foundation actually won the first court battle in a lower court in one of the county courts where we filed. And then it went up to the state Supreme Court. And that is when the Washington State Supreme Court ruled that it was not, in fact, unconstitutional. It clearly is, according to the state constitution. But they have just decided they're going to rule the way they want to rule because they want to take your money. And so what this means is if you live in Washington, but maybe you have a home in Idaho, and you sell that home, Washington can tax you on your Idaho home, even though you are going to pay Idaho taxes on your Idaho home.
Oh, stop it.
No, this is why it is so egregious. This means this ruling being allowed to stand means that financial gains in any other state, Washington can reach their hands into that state's boundaries and get tax money out of it.
Because they're essentially a resident of the state. Is that right?
Right. Yes. So if you are a full or, you know, partial, every state has, you know, so many days that you live there, you are considered a resident of that state, whereas you might have property in another state. Mm-hmm. But for these Washington residents, you may have property somewhere else. You may have a business across state lines. Mm-hmm. You may have inherited something in another state and you want to sell it. But if you make any capital gains Washington can reach outside of their boundaries and tax in another state and get that tax money.
And the threshold is $250,000. Is that what you said?
Yes. Yes. Any certain capital gains income exceeding $250,000 in a year would be taxed at 7%.
Does that also include any stocks and bonds?
I believe that it does. To the best of my ability, I believe so. But, you know, in our court filings, we use the example, you know, if California wanted to do this, they could go after someone who perhaps sold some firearms. Let's say in Florida. Let's say that they, you know, had some sort of business and they sold guns in Florida. California could come and tax the income made on those firearms. Or if you were in Utah, a resident of Utah, and perhaps you had some sort of financial dealings in alcohol. So we're not, I mean, this could be a conservative state as well if they decide they want to go after some money. It just opens a Pandora's box. It's quite frankly, very scary when states no longer have to abide by the boundaries of their own laws, and now they can reach into other states. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court said they're not going to hear it, and it's very disappointing. So we'll see what happens here. We might have to take another court case to the Supreme Court, but Washington state residents will have an opportunity to vote on a ballot initiative this coming November. And we can just hope and pray that Washington taxpayers and voters stand up and say, no, we're not going to let this stand and vote down the initiative. So that's our next hope.
When the Supreme Court doesn't take a case, do they just say we are not taking it, we reject the case, or do they have to give a reason?
They do not have to give a reason, and they did not give a reason. Now, they held on. So the Supreme Court will conference typically on Fridays in November, December, January to see what cases they're going to take up for the next term. And this capital gains tax case, it was delayed a couple of times. It was supposed to be heard in November. It got delayed. So we knew that there was some consideration going on, but they ultimately decided not to hear it. So the lower court ruling stands. The Washington State Supreme Court. And now we see if it's not overturned with the ballot initiative in November, what are other states going to do in response? Because this could open the floodgates.
It's kind of interesting to me because what if the real estate, for instance, was in a trust? A trust is necessarily protected, is it not?
It should be. That's why you set up a trust, right? But they've just made this up, even though it's against the state constitution in Washington. They passed it anyway. They signed it into law, and their courts protected their legislatures.
Well, the other fascinating thing is that something like this could lead to, I don't want to say, kind of an alternate method of payment here, but if somebody could necessarily put something into other kinds of vehicles, payment vehicles, you know, let's say that, you know, John Smith, a resident of Washington State, was selling a piece of real estate out in Nevada, and instead of claiming any kind of capital gains, that he would necessarily reinvest that money in Nevada or some other state. So he never realizes the gain. Or you pay cash and you pay it, you know, in any denomination below the threshold of anything that's in the Patriot Act. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I can see where things would lead to some other kind of, I don't want to say secretive method, but some other kind of method such that, you know, people are pretty savvy and some lawyers are pretty savvy and they'll come up with some other, you know, lanes to deal with something like this. Are you seeing that?
Well, not yet that I'm aware of, but you are correct. When it comes to protecting your assets, protecting what you have worked for your entire life to give to your next generation, people are going to be protective of that. And These politicians who have no claim on your work. These politicians have no claim on the work that you have built, but they are going to make these people out to be the bad guy because they get creative in protecting their assets. And it's really because the politicians think that they are owed your money and they refuse to be responsible with other people's money. And so they're going to come up with ways to take more and more and more. And they're going to make the taxpayers the bad guy if they have a problem with this. So,
what kind it is the state of Washington in the same kind of percentage debt as say California is? Is this a desperate move to help the balance sheet for the state of Washington?
I'm not sure that it's that so much as it is that during
just power.
Power, raw power. And also, Washington State, they shut down during COVID. They shut down businesses, schools, of course, and they started seeing a lot of people leave. And as did a lot of these states like Illinois, the states that shut down saw their tax base get up and leave because if they had the means to do so to make a better life for their family and get their kids back in school, they wanted to do that. And I think it didn't occur to a lot of these politicians that they couldn't trap you in those states. But so when they found out that they couldn't trap you and people were voting with their feet and they were leaving, this then becomes punitive. It is a way to say, we're not going to let you out of our clutches. We're going to punish you for leaving this state. We're going to get every last dime out of you before you are out from under us. And it's about power and control and punishment.
So what does a resident do? Do they kind of break down? What is it? The theft ratio in the state of California is anything below $950. They don't even bother to prosecute. So it's kind of like if it's under $250,000, or let's say that the capital gains was over $250,000, do they break it down into piece parts so it's below $250,000? I can see a lot of maneuvers here that these investors or these business owners or these residents would necessarily have to go through. You need some pretty savvy tax people, yes?
Oh yeah, I do believe so. I think people are going to get creative. They're going to find ways to challenge this in court or make the government find them and come after them. And they shouldn't have to do that.
Right.
Let's be honest, they shouldn't have to do this. But yeah, I think we might see some very interesting and creative ways of filing taxes, of filing financial gains. And these people aren't the bad people for trying to do that. Let's all remember, the government thinks they have a claim on your money. You worked for this, you earned it, and it should be yours to do with as you choose. So let's all remember, the government is the one who thinks that they can come into your back pocket simply because they will not be responsible with other people's money. They don't believe they have to, and this court ruling just simply enforced that they don't have to. It reinforced the thought that if they want that money, they can go get that money.
Well, if this goes against the state constitution, how could a court, help me with that one. I'm kind of lost. Does the constitution not mean anything to these judges?
Well, Denise, in Florida, you have some better courts that you get to deal with than you deal with in Washington.
Sorry.
They just kind of make things say what they want them to say sometimes.
I'm looking at something here, so help me with this. It's on a website, listwithclever.com, which is a real estate blog. And there's a question here that says, one of the biggest concerns when selling a home, what are the tax implications? Here's our guide about what you need to know about capital gains tax on property sold out of state. It's a question that all homeowners have after the jubilation of selling their home? Will there be a capital gains tax on the sale? The simple answer is no. Whether or not you pay a capital gains tax at the federal or state level depends on a variety of factors, including your location. There are only 9 states without capital gains taxes. They are Washington, Nevada, Texas, Wyoming, South Dakota, Tennessee, Florida, Alaska, and New Hampshire. So there you go. There is no capital gains, right?
Well, there wasn't. Maybe until last week. I don't know what to tell you, Denise. I was honestly dumbfounded when I realized the Supreme Court wasn't going to take this case, because this does have national implications. This is going to spread, just as we started talking about at the beginning of this conversation. What happens on the West Coast tends to spread to the rest of the country sooner or later. We're all going to have to deal with this. So it's hugely disappointing that the Supreme Court decided not to hear it. Hopefully the voters in Washington will vote this down with their initiative in November. But even if so, there is now court precedent that this could be enacted in a state. So is California going to run full steam ahead?
Or any of these others? I mean, that's just, so this has now put, you know, accountants and real estate people and financial consultants, it's put a lot of people not only on notice, but I mean, these professionals that have degrees and, you know, resumes dealing in capital gains and real estate and business transactions and so forth. I imagine that, you know, they could, I don't know, should there be, is there, if you can't go to the Supreme Court, should there be a class action suit? Is that something that's still in a possibility?
You know, we at the Freedom Foundation are still trying to figure out what other options do we have here. And I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. We filed this case in 2021 on behalf of 7 residents in Washington State. Does that grow once they have now been paying taxes for a couple of years? Mm-hmm. There is standing perhaps to bring another lawsuit. So we're not done. We're not done fighting this. The Freedom Foundation is considering all options on the table here.
Well, as I, again, I use the word incubation, because what necessarily works in one state just seems to find itself in legislation. And that's because, you know, you've got these organizations that concoct these missions, these objectives, and then they go to, you know, a handful of people in the legislature and give them a little bit of money and say, introduce this, see if you can get this passed, and, you know, there'll be a reward on the other end. And mm-hmm. the next thing, you know, I mean, don't think that they're not coordinating with other state legislatures.
They compare notes.
And so do the state attorneys general. They do the same thing. So, I'm guessing that your governor did, in fact, sign this into law. Is that right?
He did. Now, let's be clear, Denise. I live in Virginia, so I am not under Jay Inslee's clutches. But
okay.
but half of my organization is. So, yes. Now, we filed, I believe, the day after the state legislature finally enacted it into law, and it was sent to Jay Inslee's desk. We filed it before he signed it, but he went ahead and signed it. So, yeah, it is the law of the land in Washington.
Okay, well, is he impeachable?
And now we have to hope the voters change it.
Can you impeach the governor?
Oh my, there would have been so many reasons prior to
this. I hear you. Well, Ashley Varner, Freedom Foundation, we certainly appreciate the explanation here. I think it's put a lot of my listeners on heightened alert here, that they can be asking some different questions now, what's going on in their respective state legislatures. So thank you for sharing some time with us, and we appreciate you coming and explaining it all to us. Well done. Ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way on the Denise Simon Experience. Stay with us.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. At 4 a.m, my phone rang. They said, I regret to inform you that your husband was wounded in action. Victor sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. I was doing school full time, and I was also then caring for Victor. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself. I just didn't want to forget that I also had goals and that I also had a life. What I did is I challenged Victor to meet me halfway. There are almost 6 million military and veteran caregivers across the nation. We have our own journey, and we can fulfill that journey at the same time that we are helping our loved one.
Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. We are so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. I want to introduce you to Samuel Ronan. He is a veteran of the U.S. Air Force and quite the patriot, I might add. He's dipping his toes into the world of politics, which I would say is as much as a blood sport almost as it is being in the military. But Sam has agreed to share some time with us, especially with the things that are going on in the Middle East. So, Sam, thank you so much for your service, but also thank you for sharing some time with us.
No, thank you, Denise, for having me. That's what this is all about.
Isn't that the truth? I my audience knows that I do another radio show out of Tampa, and it's always a question of what we're doing in the Middle East. And I often get asked the question, so help me with this one, because I'm not sure I give the right answers anymore, that we can't be the world's police. And I kind of argue that we almost have to, not in the conventional definition, but if we're not, nobody else is. And the world's getting uglier by the minute. But it doesn't mean being the world's police that you have to go into a full-blown armed military conflict. Is that true?
I agree, actually. Yay. If I may, to your point is that the United States of America, in any other point in history, would be considered the empire of America, right? So we have over 100 military installations across the globe. All right. What other culture and nation has ever done that in the history and only been one individual country? None. Right. The Chinese did it when they were growing in Asia. The Mongols did it when they were conquering literally everything. The Romans did it when they conquered the Mediterranean. Right. So we are an empire. So it's less that we are a military police or the world police. It's that we are an empire and we are acting as such. We are comporting ourselves as such. But unlike other empires of the past, where their presence was enough to be a deterrent, ours is no longer the case because the world has evolved. It's become much, much, much smaller, right? The fear of the unknown, the fear of the immortal Roman legion is no longer this myth. We know what the military can do, the United States military. We've seen it. We know what it does. We know that the politics surround it. There's the internet. There's as much information going back beyond even World War One, that kind of describes how we've gotten to from there to here. So all that to say, the TLDR version of that is to say, we aren't the world police. We are a global empire, and we are one of few nations that have foreign military outposts. And in fact, we're the only ones that it seems to be acceptable, because if China starts trying to develop their outposts or Russia, we have the USSR and communist China all over again, which is considered a global threat to Western nations. So do we need to have our world presence? That could be debatable. Do we need to engage in military conflict every other Tuesday? Absolutely not. We have the strongest military. We have the strongest economy. we could sanction the bejesus out of any other country in the world and devastate them this way and have a much more immediate and long-term impact on them acting out or aggressively to their neighbors. Short answer.
Gatestone Institute had a piece about a week ago that, I mean, you speak about an empire. It appears to me what is happening is that militant Islam is actually expanding their empire, and they're doing it by lots of methods. And some of those methods include things like, you know, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, AQAP, Houthis, you know, militias in Iraq. So is that something that we should not tolerate? Is that something that we should control? I mean, if we see what's going on with Hezbollah and Hamas, we see that, you know, it affects global shipping. It affects Western nations. I mean, help me with this one, Mr. Sam.
Yeah. So in terms of terrorist organizations, specifically, like you were saying, Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah, which is trying to become a nuclear superpower, that we cannot tolerate, right? If you're literally creating a terrorist organization, and let's define this word clearly, right? Terrorism is acts of violence for political change or gain within your philosophy, right? So terrorism is to literally overthrow through acts of violence and instill fear upon the population so that your philosophy, your political views are then established as the norm. Now, things like Hamas and some few other organizations out there that are labeled as terrorists are really just defending themselves and their nation by taking up arms, right? Because by that very same definition, Hamas is the Palestinian, I guess, liberation front from against Israel, which is a nuclear superpower with an established military trying to literally erase Palestine off of the map with, you know, millions of tons of ordnance over the course of, you know, months and years and decades against a state, the Palestinian state, that does not have a standing military, does not have control over their own food, water, or electricity, and whose casualties consist mostly of children and the elderly, right? So, which goes into, you know, definitions of war crimes. But in general, Hamas is a self-defense force, just like the colonies during the War of Independence would have been considered terrorists by today's standards, right? Because we weren't part of the West at the time. We were a colony of England, and we were upstarts. We didn't want to pay our taxes because we weren't being represented. We fought a war, and then the French ended up supporting us in that French-English proxy war and used the American frontier as the landing mat, right? So all of that has to be understood when talking about terrorism and what can and cannot be accepted. Right now, Israel is committing genocide against Palestine, period, dot, end of story. By every definition of what is happening in that conflict, it is a genocide, which is why several countries have already came forward in the United Nations and, you know, raised charges against Israel for that reason. Yemen, blocking that strait across Africa, is disrupting Western trade, and it's because Westerners are supporting Israel, which is supporting the genocide, which is against international law. If Yemen, or rather if the West would stop supporting Israel, Yemen would stop the blockade, trade would continue, and then all that pressure could be put on Israel instead. What has happened instead is that the United States is choosing side with Israel because the current administration is extremely bloodthirsty. They are one of the most hawkish administrations in American history, and they're democratic, which is historically pacifistic, not hawkish. So you have all sorts of just historical conundrums conspiring all at once here. And so to answer the question, can we abide terrorism? Absolutely not. But when we are the ones aiding and abetting certain elements of terrorism, then who holds us accountable, if not the American people, holding the administration accountable at the polls, or even by calling for recalls and requittals and all these other political constitutional elements that can you know, like impeachment and stuff like that. You know, we are in a modern world with modern solutions to these old world problems. You said Islamic extremism being growing. It's the same reason why militant Islam. Sorry. So militant Islam is growing. You're right, because Western nations have been occupying, disrupting, and basically attacking the Middle East for decades, disrupting their country, their infrastructure, their stability outright. I mean, Yemen used to be a beautiful country, mm-hmm. and now it's rubble. Same thing with Iraq and Iran. What would happen, do you think, if the same stuff happened here in the United States? Would we just sit there and take it, or would we fight back? We would fight back. So to the West, what's happening in the Middle East is terrorism. To the Middle Easterners, what the West is doing to them is terrorism, right? So in order to have that conversation, we have to understand our role in the circumstance. If we instead imposed economic sanctions, we wouldn't be terrorists to them. We would still be perhaps their enemy, but you wouldn't create a terrorist organization or a counter threat to an economic sanction. You only do that when there's military involved, when there's combat involved. So these, I guess, militant Islamic extremists are in their minds defending their homeland, their country, from the Western occupiers, the Western colonizers, who in their minds and subjective reality are just there to take oil and other resources. And when you have that part of the conversation, it starts to make more sense that the West isn't necessarily the bad guys, but we're also not the good guys. We're doing what we've always done. We want resources, but instead of, you know, being able to figure out a trade agreement, we're like, okay, screw that. We're going to go ahead and invade and take it from you. If instead we had resolved this peacefully through trade, we wouldn't have the instability in the Middle East. But some, you know, bean counter in the 80s or in the early 90s was like, you know what, we should just invade, remove all these people, paint a picture that this guy and this guy and this guy are terrorist leaders, train these guys to fight against the USSR, and then we'll just take their oil fields. And that worked for several decades until it didn't. And now we're just mired in the Middle East, and the Middle East is unstable, and it's just this mess. And it goes back to, why is the United States of America acting like an empire of pure violence when we have the economic means and leadership means to do all of this without having to fire a single shot?
Are you a advocate for giving up land for peace?
So that is a very good question. And I love the way that it sets me up for this answer. I am not for giving up land for peace. I am for finding peace, whether or not land is given up, right? In the sense that, what land are we giving up? Are we giving up our stronghold and our foothold in Iran and Iraq? Well, that's not ours to begin with. Are we talking about Israel needs to be a state somewhere else, and would we consider bringing them into the United States of America instead? I think that could be an interesting option, much like giving statehood to the top 11 indigenous tribes in our own country. That could have some very interesting implications, since there's already tribal land in treaty land that gets violated by corporate interests and even American interests all the time. What if they had states' rights to truly defend their lands and truly empower their treaty lands? I think it is very interesting to have that conversation. But if we're talking about giving land back that wasn't ours to begin with, then yes, we should. It's not our land, right? And that's the premise of so much conflict throughout human history. And if that gives peace, well, then yeah, then that is a simple solution. But to give back land that is in fact ours, or that should have never been occupied by others in the first place, then no, that's capitulation. And that's weakness, and that's something that we cannot afford to do.
So Putin wants Alaska back. Should we give him Alaska back so we can have peace with Russia?
Well, as we found out, Russia's not much of a threat anyway. If Ukrainian farmers can hop on an airplane and keep the entire Russian military at bay. So as far as that scenario goes, no, we don't need to give Alaska back. There's no reason to give Alaska back. For one, Russia isn't trying to occupy it, and we got it fair and square. What I'm talking about, I think you're also talking about, is the Israel-Palestine situation. Palestine was the country to begin with. They offered shelter to Jews who were fleeing Europe during the, World War II. And then there was the Nakba War, which Israel ended up winning, and formed the state of Israel, and then started colonizing the rest of Palestine and committing ethnic cleansing in the process. So in that regard, Israel is in the wrong and has been in the wrong since the very beginning. It's their version of manifest destiny. Are we right for having manifest destiny all of, North America? No, we're not. But we are established. And what we can do is ensure that the lands that continue to exist as sovereign states for these Native Americans and their tribes is to respect those boundaries and even offer up things like statehood to them so that they can truly enforce and have a say in what happens in their land. Because right now, I believe there's only two tribes that have spots in Congress, but they don't have a vote. It's all, ceremonial. They don't have any real say, but they can vote. And that's not helping anything. So to your point, land and conquest is something that if it's an established sovereign state and it is being taken by another state for their self-preservation, is that right or wrong? It's wrong if the person taking that state, that land, for their self-preservation is doing it to eradicate the original. Because Palestine had already formed an agreement with Israel to give them part of their country so that there could be a two-state solution, and that was in 1949. So I think if we actually go and look at the history and look at the treaties that were signed and established and agreed upon by the leading parties, then we could in fact find peace without necessarily having to capitulate or give back anything that was gained.
The breakup of the Soviet Union caused a lot of territories to become independent countries. And Putin is certainly going after Ukraine. So what part of Ukraine should legitimately then, under your argument, go back to Russia, or should it?
Well, it goes back to the argument of, if you go back far enough, right, everything should go back to Samaria. Everything should go back to ancient Persia. Everything should go back to Alexander the Great or ancient Rome, right? Because those were the empires that existed prior to. But if you look at when Russia became the USSR, they absorbed Ukraine as its individual state. Ukraine existed as its own country. Mm-hmm. And when the USSR fell apart, it retained its borders and its sovereignty, or rather it got it restored. So to say that what part of Ukraine should go back to Russia, none, because Ukraine never belonged to Russia in the first place. It's like saying Austria should go back to Germany. That was never the case. It, maybe in ancient times during the Roman era, Germania spread from Western Spain all the way to Poland. Well, no, those are now established sovereign countries, right? What really comes into play is creating imaginary lines across like Africa, or even the Middle East, and trying to establish those kinds of boundaries from those countries when their cultures, their civilizations, and their history did not respect those boundaries, but Western imposition forced it upon them. That caused a lot of instability in both Africa and the Middle East in the first place. So trying to compare those two scenarios is difficult at best, because Ukraine was a sovereign state to begin with. The USSR tried to absorb them through military might and did. And then when that fell apart, their sovereignty was simply restored as it should have always been.
And so Crimea was given up by Gorbachev to Ukraine. And here comes Putin and he takes Crimea back. What happens there? I mean, who has dominion over, legitimately then, who has dominion over Crimea?
So if you're talking about legitimacy, then Crimea should always belong to Ukraine, right? That is always how it should be. Just like Washington, D.C. should always belong to the United States, Berlin should always belong to Germany. If some other nation conquers Germany or the United States, God forbid, to the victor goes the spoils. So we're talking about two different scenarios here. Putin has failed to capture Ukraine, and he will continue to fail to capture the Ukraine. If he did, right, if that was actual conquest and it actually happened, then by right of conquest, Putin would in fact control Crimea, but that doesn't mean it is correct. Ukraine deserves its sovereignty, and that cannot be infringed or stated any stronger than that.
All right, then help me with, you've got a situation here, kind of going back to Israel. What about the Sinai Peninsula?
The Sinai Peninsula. Remind me
Israel was attacked and they ended up going to war with Egypt over the Sinai. Israel prevailed and pretty much said, you know, we won't tolerate this, but if you want Sinai, you can have it. So Egypt has Sinai, and you know, that is certainly part of air quote Palestine, as is Jordan. So help me with that one.
No, so that's where I went with the Western nations trying to create imaginary lines in the sand, separating these nations in the way they want to and feel that they should be, right? Egypt has been a power longer than any other country, I think, except for maybe China. And even then, I think Egypt has historically simply been around longer as an actual nation state. So that being said, we could have the argument that the entire Middle East and most of Africa should be Egyptian anyway, right? Again, we're trying to have there is no solution to the conflicting history of empire, right? Because at the end of the day, what the West is doing is saying to the victor goes the spoils. And if that's the argument, then what's happening with Israel and Palestine is simply something that we need to wait to see how it comes out, which would be Israel commits genocide against Palestine and wipes them off the map. The same thing that happened to Israel before it became Israel by Hitler, right? Had Hitler succeeded, the Jewish population just would cease to exist on Earth. Would that have been justified? Had Hitler won the war? Had the Axis powers won the war? Would we be having this conversation? Was it justified to eradicate the Jews, then to eradicate the queers, then to eradicate the infirm and people with disabilities, transgender, and so on and so forth, right? We'd be having that conversation. We'd be having additional conversations about, well, we should erase, you know, Africa from existence and re-enslave all African nations so that they could generate resources, right? To the victor goes the spoils. I'm not arguing historically that's the case. What I am arguing is that in our current socio-geopolitical climate, right, what is happening in the Middle East is being, what's the word that I'm looking for here, perpetrated by Western forces. And Israel attacking its neighbors and claiming, you know, self-defense because, you know, we're Jewish and we're Semitic and we were holocausted against by the Germans is no longer holding up, because now people have a broader understanding of what's happening in that region. The internet is helping. And we're seeing in real time the atrocities that Israel is committing. So the fact that Egypt agreed to whatever they agreed to with Israel is one thing, but the fact that it still infringes upon Palestine is indicative of this conqueror is correct mentality. This is still Palestinian land. It's still, you know, Palestinian control. But because Palestine is not strong enough to defend itself, Egypt and Israel are talking behind Palestine's back and making decisions about Palestine. It's exactly why Poland disappeared from the map twice in less than 100 years. It's because the winners of World War I and World War II were like, well, we can just divvy up Poland. And then after the war, it's like, ah, sorry about that. Here you go, Poland. You can be a state again. It's that kind of conversation. So on the one hand, if you're talking about conquest or might makes right, then yes, might makes right. But if you're talking about ethics and the morality of sovereign states, then sovereignty must remain king, must remain true, must remain the number one goal.
Would your argument hold up then for Lebanon? Because Lebanon was a Christian country, and it's been really taken over by Hezbollah. It's got no real functioning government. And it is part of the Levant, additionally, air quote, part of Palestine. So we have militant Islam that has taken over Lebanon, correct?
One could very much so argue that. And to your point, and I think I know where you're going with this, is do cultural and religious influences equate to the same thing as military attacks? And that is why I said trade should be the solution to every international conflict, right? And by international, I mean even neighboring states, just to be clear on that. But when you talk about ideology, how do you fight back against ideology, right? You martyr them if you kill them. You alienate them if you dismiss them, or you martyr them by creating them or turning them into a minority group and persecuting them, right? So ideology must stand on its own. So if militant Islam is wreaking havoc on Lebanon because Lebanese culture or beliefs or values couldn't resist the militantness, right? Then that is a problem that needs to be addressed in that way. The militant aspect, right, the whole terrorism of how we described acts of terror is to create acts of violence, to instill fear, to perpetrate and propagate an established or pursued ideology, then yes, militant Islam, Hezbollah in this case, is in fact something that is a threat and should be treated as an actual military threat, a threat to a society as a whole, and should be defended against. And I believe the Lebanese government is trying to do that at least. But again, because the Middle East is so unstable right now because of the decades upon decades of war, they're unable to do so. And the only nation with any sort of military veteran experience is the United States. And we're seeing that as these conflicts around the globe progress and develop further, we're seeing that the Russian military hasn't seen real action. The Ukrainian military has not seen real action. So what you're seeing is novices fighting against each other to a standstill. Yeah, sure, Russia has more resources and they're gaining ground, but they're not going to be able to conquer Ukraine with what's been happening. Same thing with China. China can tout all day long that they have a very strong, very powerful military, but what they have is a large nuclear arsenal and a large economy to flex around. And if you notice, that's how China has been building its influence the most in its region, is economically, not through military conquest or influence or threats of military conquest and influence, which is why I'm saying that all of these military conversations aside, the strongest economy is what will ultimately right the wrongs or set the stage of a given region. And if you just rely on the military, you will ultimately fail because you will burn yourself out, you will exhaust your resources, your troops, and the morale of your country. That's why Americans don't support the war effort anymore. We don't want another Vietnam. We don't want another global war on terror. We want to build high-speed rail. We want to address the rising cost of living. We want, you know, our taxes to go to things that actually benefit Americans. And we want jobs to be kept in America instead of being sent to China. You know, these are the things that Americans value most. But instead, the administration focuses on war, 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 violence, and war. You see what I'm saying?
I hear your point. I'm not sure I agree with much of it, but I hear your point and I appreciate your point. You know, and I would, you know, certainly look at what the Taliban has done to Afghanistan. So, I mean, that comes, that really comes down to what's going on there today is, you know, human rights violations. I mean, what they're doing to women, what they're doing to just the general population that is terrified of the Taliban. And it's Afghanistan, you know, back during the Kennedy administration was a pretty stable place, not so much anymore.
Thank you
for that one. We appreciate you spending some time with us and your perspective. And again, we give you a hat tip and a handshake for your military service, so thank you for that. It's been an interesting conversation, and thank you for sharing your angle on it all. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way on the Denise Simon Experience. Stay with me.
The Conversation Starter. This is Talk 92.1, WDDQ 8L Valdosta.